I am Plant Online. This is thecommentary.ca. According to my next guest, where you choose to live is perhaps more important than deciding what career you choose to pursue or who you choose to marry. In the global economy, where we live determines what careers we have and who we meet. That the good ideas that emerge from a city come from the sort of good people that inhabit that city. Richard Florida is the author of a new book that's already a bestseller, and which has been widely discussed, Who's Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where to Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life. His previous books, The Rise of the Creative Class and The Flight of the Creative Class, were bestsellers. He's one of the world's leading public intellectuals on economic competitiveness, demography, and cultural innovation. Esquire named him one of the best and brightest. A professor of business and creativity at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto, he is also the director of the Martin Prosperity Institute there. Who's Your City is published by Random House and retails for $32.95. I am pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program Richard Florida. Good morning, Professor Florida.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Thanks very much for joining us. For people that didn't read the first two books, what is the creative class?
Well, the creative class is really the driving force of our economy and the big factor in all the changes we see around us in work, you know, the way we work, telecommuting flexibly, the way we live, our lifestyles, the leisure activities. We take on this quest for more active leisure, no longer just sitting in front of a TV, and the kind of communities we want to live in. With a whole group of researchers, we identified this group of people. Like the working class was blue-collar workers who worked in factories, the creative class are people who work with our minds. It's scientists, technology people, innovators, entrepreneurs, researchers. But it's also artists, designers, musicians, writers, entertainers. You know, entertainment is a bigger industry today than autos or steel. And then people who work in the professions, educators, healthcare workers, healthcare medical workers, people who work in the legal field, and so on. When we look at the total of this group of people, the creative class, it's about 45 to 50 million people in North America. U.S. or Canada, it's 35 to 40% of the total workforce. And as a force in our economy, if you add up every single wage and salary paid in North America and say that there are three big classes, there's the service class, people who work in restaurants, landscapers, people who provide these services. There's the manufacturing class, blue-collar workers in factories and in construction. And the creative class, the artists, the scientists, the professionals that I mentioned, that creative class accounts for more than half of all wages and salaries paid and about three-quarters of all discretionary purchasing power. So it's an economic power group in our society.
The average person in North America, they move how many times roughly?
Well, it's hard to say because young people move so much more than old people. And you know, there are a group of people that are highly mobile that move many times. I'm one of them. I've moved 17 times in the past 20 years. What you can say is that 40 to 50 million Americans move each and every, North Americans move each and every year. And about 15 to 20 million of us make a big, big, big move. We move to a new city. We move to a new state or province. So while that may be 10% of us moving every year, when you add that up over the course of a life, it's quite a bit.
When you say that in the book that where you live is the most important decision that you'll make, has it always been that way, or is it just because of the rise of the creative class, as the title your previous book suggests?
Well, I think the rise of a global, first we'll say a global, and then a idea-driven economy. Take those two ideas together, a global world and an idea-driven world. I think this is what makes mobility, one, more doable. We have the technology. We no longer have to go on a sailboat or, you know, try to paddle across water or walk across deserts. I mean, we have the technology available to us, and a technology that connects us pretty easily back home. You know, we have computers and emails and telecommunications and wireless and cell phones. So we have a technology that keeps us connected while allowing us to move. I think that's what's happened is that for the first time in human history, it's no longer that we just have to migrate, you know, to leave terrible economies or to find food or to find manufacturing work. That particular kinds of work have become highly concentrated. You know, if you want to be an investment banker, you've got to be in London or New York or Hong Kong, and maybe you can do it in Toronto, but you can't do it for if you want to be a professional musician, you've got to go to, you know, L.A. or maybe you can make it in Toronto, but you, or Nashville. You know, if you want to work in software development, boy, oh boy, you better be in, you know, the Pacific Northwest or the Silicon Valley in California. If you want to be an actor, it's going to have to be L.A. or a few other places that you can make it in film acting. So the point is, economic activity has become more specialized by place, so that if people want to pursue a career at this high level, they got to get up and go. And so what the book is saying is that's not a great thing. You know, when you have to move, like I did 17 times in 20 years, you're pulled away from your family, you miss your mom and dad, you miss your brothers and sisters and the friends you grew up with. It's not an easy thing. And what the book is saying, Who's Your City, you have to balance that. How much do the family ties, the local relationships mean to you? How much does that career mobility mean to you? And how do you balance that in your own life? And what the book is saying is that there's not a best city. You know, it's not like that London is the best city or New York's the best city or Vancouver or Toronto or San Francisco or Paris or Tokyo are the best city. It's saying you have to find the best city that fits you and suits your needs. So, but I do think that mobility is more important. If you're going to make an economic success, if you're going to have ambition, mobility has to figure into your calculations because it's increasingly associated. You know, I say in the book, economic upward mobility increasingly turns on our ability to be geographically mobile as well.
One of the great things about this book is that there's fascinating maps in there, and I mean, you could spend hours looking at them. Well, one of the first maps in the book, and the first few maps, I should say, deal with, contrary to what Tom Friedman said, that the world is flat, that you contend that it's actually quite spiky. And explain those spikes. Those are, when you talked about if you want to make it as an actor, you have to live in California or in that area. Thus, you see the spike rather high because of economic activity. Is that correct?
Yeah, and for folks listening in, if you want to see the maps, just go, you know, click, if you're in front of your computer, just click on Who's Your City, whosyourcity.com, and they'll all just pop up in front of you. So you can see these spiky maps that we're talking about. But, yeah, what we did was map where the real economy is. We used some interesting techniques. We took the satellite images of the world at night, and we mapped where innovation occurs in the world economy. We mapped where real, new, important discoveries take place. And lo and behold, this whole idea that place isn't important, that there's a dead, you know, distance is dead, you know, you can live wherever you please, out by a, you know, a stream or out in the forest or on a hilltop. This whole idea that Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, says the flat world is flat, he says, flat world we live in. You know, it's not true. It's a myth. The world is very, very geographically concentrated. There are about, according to the statistics we were able to create, 40 mega-regions in the world, the Pacific Northwest, we call it Cascadia, Northern California, Southern California, the West Coast, you know, Boswash, the Boston-New York-Washington corridor, and then Tor-Buffchester, where I live, London, Tokyo, and on, Ambrus-Torp in Europe, have lots of funny names in the book. We got a great deal of humor doing those names. But the point is, 40 of these mega regions, which have about 18% of the world's population, produce 2/3 of our economic output and 9 in 10 of our innovation. So the world is becoming clustered and concentrated around these giant population and economic centers, and that's not slowing down. In fact, for folks listening in, you know, this past year was the first year in human history that, according to the United Nations, more than 50% of the world's people live in urban areas, no longer in rural areas and farm communities and agriculture. 50% of us are urban, and 2/3 of our overall world economic output account come from just 40 locational clusters or mega regions in the world. So we're becoming a very, very concentrated species in these cities and mega regions, we humans.
Those spikes, where they mean economic, the economic factors that they mean for people listening, talent, innovation, creativity. Obviously, Richard, they're not evenly distributed. Should they be?
Oh, I know. The world I want, you know, every day I wake up and I wish for a world that was more equal, where people were valued better, where everyone's creativity was part of the mix. That's what keeps me going. But the world as it is doesn't look like that. The world as it is looks incredibly unequal, economically, socially, and geographically. And my fear, and one of the reasons I wrote this book, one was to give people advice on how to have a better life in this terribly economic economically and socially and geographically unequal. Be aware, understand it. But two was to get wake-up call, you know, for policymakers and business leaders who are kind of just asleep at the wheel of the world. I mean, they're completely, you know, they're taking a snooze at the wheel of the world economy. They're ignoring this. They don't want to see it. And the world is incredibly concentrated and spiky. And the words of my Chinese research assistant graduate student that I quote in the book said it best. We did a big study of China, trying to understand how spiky and uneven China is. And when it came back, there was this giant spike called Shanghai in Beijing, where all of the Chinese ambitious and innovative and entrepreneurial and talented people, all of the innovation is, all of the big economic activity is. And we're looking at that. He said, Professor Florida, I want to be respectful of you. He said, but in Shanghai, I'm only a 20-something-year-old guy. And quite honestly, I work hard. I live better than you do. I have more economic opportunity than a professor in the United States. He said, but the people who live outside of Shanghai live in, these are his words, pre-civilized conditions. So we have a world that economic outcomes, depending on where you live, and not just economic outcomes, social outcomes and health, your human health, depend on where you live. And that world is not getting any more even, is getting more uneven. And I think I could wish it to be another way, but in order to change it, our political and business leaders are going to have a giant wake-up call. And the time for the wake-up call is now. We can no longer continue down this road because people are getting angry. And that anger is expressing itself in terrorism in the Middle East, but it's also expressing itself in a culture war that you guys have just seen play out in my country, the United States, in this incredible battle between Obama, the creative class candidate, and Hillary Clinton, the ostensible candidate of blue-collar, you know, and service economy America. That can no longer continue. We need societies to be more integrated and holistic, and that's going to take a big political wake-up call. And the time for that wake-up call is now.
But should people that live in, I guess, in flatter regions of the world, should they congregate to the mega regions?
Well, that's why I wrote the book, and that's why I built this tool, also at the website at HoosierCity.com, called the Place Finder. I think you really have to make that decision on a case-by-case, on an individual-by-individual basis. How close do you need in your career to be in a spiky center? Can you live outside and teleconnect to that spiky center? Is the spiky center, with its congestion and very high-cost housing, is that a place you want to be, or do you want a more sylvan lifestyle? Do you want to live in a more affordable housing market? Can you find ways to connect? What stage of life? I think for a young person starting out in their career, you know, 9 out of 10 times, they're going to have to be in one of these spiky centers because that's where the action is. That's where the labor market is. That's where the career opportunities are. That's where the boys and girls are. I mean, that's where you're going to meet people, make friends, and find a wife or a husband or, you know, a significant other. For people with a family, I think there's another choice with kids, and then you have to balance that. And I think the empty nesters have the, you know, when the kids have moved away, have most choice of all. And what I talk about in the book, they can choose a wide range of places. So I really think it depends on the individual, your career needs, your lifestyle, your life stage, what you want. And then you have to be smart about it. And, you know, what I found in writing this book is that most people not only pay more attention to their job and go for an interview and study the company, not only do they spend a lot more attention on who they're going to date and go out with, and they go out on lots of dates before they get married and make sure they know the person. Most people spend a lot more time picking a car, buying a used car, going to the website and looking at the options, looking at the price and the different resource guides, going to test drive. People just go to a city because they think they'd like it, they got a job transfer, they're following a boy or a girl. That's ludicrous. And so what the book is saying is you owe it to yourself, since the house is the most expensive thing you're going to buy, since your location is going to determine your career prospects and your life prospects and your dating game and how your family is going to be treated if you're married. Boy, oh boy, you owe it to yourself to pay some attention. And so the book is saying is, you know, you got to really dig in and look at cities. You got to go there. You got to take it for a test drive, and you got to be smart about it, because that place you choose to live is going to be have a big effect on your entire life. So that's the point. It's not that a spike or a not spike, an urban or a rural, a city or a suburb. You got to pick the place that's best for you, best fit for you, and the best fit for your family.
Back to this idea of the cities and regions that they need leadership, and not only from political leaders but business leaders. You say that we need more of that. Have you seen this leadership, and where at all?
Well, one of the things the book picks up on, and one of the things that I'm really intrigued by, just generally, is, you know, how absolutely clueless our national level leaders are. And I mean, maybe at the top of the list of clueless national leaders of all times is, you know, George W. Bush. He might take the cake of epitomize the clueless national leader. But I don't want to speak about Canada yet. I'm a new Canadian, but boy, oh boy, just in the Capitol Hill, I lived in Washington, D.C., there's about 485 completely clueless people. And, you know, whether you go to Moscow, whether you go to England, whether you go all over the world, the people who are running national governments are just more or less out of touch with reality. Now, what's interesting about that is, now let's take a look at the mayors. I think the mayors are actually the very, very interesting, new, innovative, in-touch leaders. You know, David Miller in Toronto, taking leadership on climate change and controlling handguns in big cities. Mike Bloomberg, a Republican turned independent, making New York City a manageable and vibrant city, trying to price the access to the city for transportation. And on the other side of the spectrum, Red Ken, the former mayor of London, left labor socialist, helping to spearhead and steward the greatest renaissance of the city in modern memory. The point is, here are three guys from three different parts of the political spectrum. All, you couldn't tell which one is a left, which one is a center, which one is a conservative, a Republican, a Democrat, a liberal, a this or that. They're all doing what it takes to make their city great, and they're doing it in a nonpartisan or postpartisan way. So I think as deadheaded as the national prime ministers and presidents are, there is a real force, and that's where business is really getting in touch with its cities, civic leaders, neighborhood groups. We call it in Toronto a prosperity agenda, bringing together business, political leaders, universities, neighborhood groups, labor groups. I think this is where the action of new models of society and of economy and of prosperity are, at the very local level. So as much as I'm dismayed by the cluelessness of the George Bushes of the world, boy, oh boy, I'm heartened by this tremendous group of mayors. And I think, you know, a recent column I said we no longer need just the United Nations of top-level leaders. We need kind of a league of mayors worldwide to showcase what the mayors of Shanghai and Beijing and Bangalore and London and Vancouver and Denver and Toronto and Rome and all over the world have been doing to kind of build new and more vibrant cities that are lifting the boats of all their citizens.
Do you think, Richard, that we're giving politicians, political leaders, too much credit or too much responsibility, perhaps, that perhaps the creative class, the creative members of the creative class should be perhaps more engaged in politics? Do you see that at all?
Yes. We have a political model that is very much an industrial age or Fordist, you know, I'm making air quotes, model, where we say, just like the great CEO is going to lead the company, the great political leader is going to lead our nation or region. That's ridiculous. I mean, you know, Toyota proved that the way to build an auto company was to get the input of the shop floor workers. Open source software shows us that the way you build great software is get the inputs of lots of different people. Wikipedia revolutionized, you know, the encyclopedia by having people as a source of information. So politics has got to change. And I think, yeah, we're moving to a post-partisan world, a new politics. And I think the Obama campaign, if anything, in the United States suggests that people really do want to be involved. They will be involved. And I think that shift has got to come. And we need maybe not only more creative ways of engagement, but an open source politics. I mean, an open source system where people have a lot more. And one of the things we found in our research doing this survey with the Gallup organization, tens of thousands of people, people want great ethical leaders from politics and business, but they want to engage. People are saying they're happier, they're better, they like their city more, they're told more people to come to their city, the more they're engaged. No, they don't want to be mayor or run the city. They want to do their part. And I think that's the kind of system we have to move to, a kind of open source politics where people are much more engaged. And all of that energy of neighborhood groups and community groups and immigrant groups and all the groups in the city is harnessed to lead to a better and a better functioning, a better managed, more efficient, and more creative city.
Reading your blog, I noted that you're working on a Canadian version of this book. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed. That's what I was doing when you called.
How does Vancouver stack up? You're in Vancouver this morning. How do we stack up, and what can we do to make this place better?
Well, first, for listeners out there, we've been working hard, I mean really hard, with a team of people in Toronto to build not only Canadian data, but to build the first ever integrated North American database. So you can compare Vancouver to Seattle, Toronto to New York, and on and on and on, and show that we're one integrated, interesting place. So we're going to put out a Canadian edition, probably early next year, with updated every single bit of information in Hoosier City to include data for all the Canadian city regions and metros, compare them to the U.S. So we're just getting the information. One of the things is, in general, Canadian metros compare very well on all measures of quality of life, of creativity, of certainly diversity and tolerance. They compare so favorably, not just the big cities, but the small cities. When you do a one-on-one comparison to a U.S. city, boy, oh boy, they just come out so nicely. But I think Vancouver is on to something special. I mean, I think, obviously, it's a very affluent town. I mean, that's the thing that just strikes you is how incredibly affluent this area is, how diverse it is, how much of the Pacific Century, I mean, how it is so connected. You know, I talked about this on the blog. You know, people wonder, what are the mega regions and metro regions of the future? I said, well, they're the West Coast. People, wake up. New York and London were great for the Atlantic economy, but it's the Vancouvers, it's the Seattles, it's the San Franciscos, it's the LAs that are so oriented to the Pacific Century that's coming up in the growth area. One of the things I think that's so special about Vancouver is that it's so diverse. It has all these diasporas that are connected back, which is going to be such an advantage. Two, as the U.S. has clamped down on immigration, Vancouver remains open-minded. It's still a place that talented and creative people from around the world can come to. That's in part why you've gotten some major relocations, like a big Microsoft Development Center coming to Vancouver. But three, and what I think is so special, I think in the past our vision of a city was this giant concrete jungle with tall office towers. Maybe Tokyo is the pinnacle of that, and New York or Chicago, and you know, no green space and the hustle and bustle of nightlife and you know, great clubs and all of this and urbanism and restaurants and lots of traffic. I think what Vancouver is doing is building a new model of urbanism, which is symbiotic with the natural environment, which is both you know, urban and green, if you will. And I think that's what the world is really looking for. And certainly my Gallup survey in the book suggests that what people are looking for is a beautiful synthesis of the urban environment and the natural environment, great parks, great green space, great tree canopy, lots of water around them. And in that sense, I think Vancouver is poised, along with, you know, maybe Sydney and Melbourne in Australia, certainly Seattle and Portland and perhaps San Francisco in the United States, Hamburg, Germany is another one of these cities, to show the world that it's not a trade-off between giant office towers and concrete blocks or a green sylvan environment, that you can have the best of both worlds. And I would like to encourage Vancouver, for folks listening in, I'd like to encourage Vancouver to help define that for the world, a natural, green, sylvan, smart, urban, energetic, kind of symbiotic, sustainable urbanism. I think that's where the world has to head, and I think that's the kind of city that's the most human and that people really want to be in.
But besides reading the book and preparing for talking to you today, I did a search of clippings and so on, and I was astonished at how much was written about you and your move to Toronto last year. Why do you think that was, and did you welcome the attention?
It was overwhelming, and I think my wife said it best. My wife, Rana, said, I don't quite understand why they think you're all that. She said a few other choice things, but it keeps me grounded. I think there's obviously a sense of great elation among Torontonians and Canadians that our time in Canada has come. And I think what people are going through is Fareed Zakaria just wrote this interesting book called The Post-American World.
Right.
I think that what's happening in Canada, in Toronto and Vancouver, Montreal, but the big cities principally, but Canada as a whole, is this real sense of what are we going to do in a post-American world? You know, America was this big, giant country with all this wealth, and Canadians in the past, you know, my Canadian friends talked about the brain drain, and now all of a sudden, people from all over the world are choosing Canada, and then Americans. I know it sounds so ludicrous to folks listening in, but, you know, some of the world's greatest scientists who used to work in America are now choosing to come to Canada, and people are saying, well, what's happening? And welcoming with open arms as a sense of we're on the map. I think we're more than on the map in Canada. I think the time has come, and with resources, with natural resources, with great coastal cities, with this great east-west thing we have going on, I think that, and with a relatively small country with a growing population that's relatively affluent. So I think I was a representation of this adaptation, this move in a quote-unquote post-American or, you know, Tokyo or Shanghai for ideas. I think we got the ideas. I think we in Canada, in these great cities, are poised on the cusp. We have the resources. I think we've got to stand up and build world models. It's not enough to say Vancouver is going to be a great city for Vancouverites. It's not enough to say Toronto is going to be a great city for Torontonians. You've got to say, now, we're going to build world models, because there's so many people back in the States that are saying, we need a model, and so many people all over Europe and Asia and the rest of the world that are saying, we need a model. I think it's our time to get up and engage the world on our terms and say, no, no, no. We are building the next phase of great cities, great communities, people-centered, inclusive, diverse, tolerant, socially aware places. And I think Canada just has that feeling, that reputation in the world. So that would be my one challenge. Let's get up and stand up and say, you know, we're no longer the little brother. And in fact, we're a big, strong, strapping teenager and young adult. We're ready to show the world what kind of model we can provide.
Richard, it's been a pleasure having you on today, and I found the book utterly fascinating, and we'll await the Canadian version with much interest, and you don't need it, but continued good luck with it.
Hey, I'll just say one other thing to listeners. As we're doing this, at the website at whosyourcity.com or creativeclass.com, if you have a story, if you want to tell us about a research report or a study, if you want to tell us about your move to Canada or within Canada or to and fro, please write us in, because as we're working on this Canadian edition of the book, we're really trying to reach out. You know, I mentioned open source before. We're trying to make our research a little bit more open source and collect inputs from a wide variety of people. So if you go to the website, if you go to the blog, you'll see our questions there. Please just write us and give us your thoughts. And thank you so much for having me on today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. The website is whosyourcity.com. Richard's other website is creativeclass.com. The book is called Who's Your City? How the Creative Economy is Making Where You Live the Most Important Decision of Your Life. $32.95 from Random House. For the commentary.ca, I'm Joseph Plata.